is brief. At least four people are dead after a shooter opened fire at a Mormon church near Flint, Michigan during a Sunday morning worship service. Eight people were injured, one critically. James Deere is with the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives.
All indications on this investigation are the suspect used an accelerant of some sort, we believe gasoline, and lit the church on fire.
In Oregon, the state files a lawsuit against the Trump administration. It's after President Trump said this weekend that troops will now head to the city of Portland. Oregon Governor Tina Kotek.
I think this is a sad day for our country, a sad day for Oregon, that the President of the United States does not listen to local leaders about what they need and how we can be in partnership.
The president says a government shutdown is likely unless top Democrats step in. Trump will meet with congressional leaders tomorrow ahead of a Wednesday deadline for lawmakers to reach an agreement on a spending bill that would avert a shutdown. CBS News Brief. I'm Matt Piper.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. Calm, quiet, and above normal temperatures will continue this week. We'll see highs in the low 80s on Monday with sunshine. For Monday night, partly cloudy, lows around 55. Tuesday, partly sunny, highs in the upper 70s. For Wednesday, partly sunny, 75.
Right now, it's 55.
Old Dutch potato chips, Old Dutch, the snappy chips.
Crispy, crunchy, light and snappy, Old Dutch potato chips.
Old Dutch, the crispiest, Old Dutch, the tastiest.
Crispy, crunchy, light and snappy, Old Dutch potato chips.
Welcome to Masters of Mystery, brought to you by Old Dutch Foods and recorded before live audience.
Old Dutch potato chips.
Old Dutch, the snappy chips.
Crispy, crunchy, light and snappy, Old Dutch potato chips.
Fans of perilous mysteries and chilling thrillers gather together in the mystery room at Lucky's 13 Pub in lovely downtown Mendota, Minnesota. Each month, the country's greatest crime writers are summoned as we dissect their literary murders, disclose their writing journeys, and perhaps persuade them to divulge the secrets behind their captivating plots. So, dear listener, settle into your comfiest armchair with your favorite Old Dutch snack and prepare to be enthralled as you are immersed in the minds of the masters of mystery. Here's your host, Rob Young.
Mystery and magic is the recipe tonight as Masters of Mystery hosts John Gaspard and Jim Cunningham. Gaspard is an author, screenwriter, director, and filmmaker. Cunningham, an actor, magician, professional master of ceremonies, and voice talent. Individually, each has made his mark, but their paths have continually intertwined since Gaspard hired Cunningham for a role in a film 30 years ago. Now Cunningham is the voice of Gaspard's Eli Marks mystery series audiobooks, and for the last 5 years, they have co-hosted a podcast that spun off from the book series called Behind the Pages, the Eli Marks Podcast, in which listeners can hear audiobook versions of the books, as well as interviews with top magicians and entertainers such as Dick Cavett, the amazing Kreskin, Lance Burton, Teller, and many, many more. And tonight they are together as Masters of Mystery. The Eli Marks series, now 10 books strong, features a young magician who uses his mind and his magic to solve murders. Gaspard has also written a second series, the Como Lake Players Mystery Series, as well as several standalone novels and a coffee table book titled Held Over, Harold and Maude at the Westgate Theater, which tells the story of how the movie Harold and Maude became a cult classic. On top of all that, he's an award-winning screenwriter and has produced and directed 6 motion pictures and written numerous books on low-budget filmmaking. Jim Cunningham is a St. Paul native who has been an actor both on stage and in front of a camera. He spent 3 years in the resident company at Dudley Riggs Brave New Workshop and was the original Tony in Tony and Tina's Wedding. Most recently, he played Groucho in the world premiere of Jeffrey Hatcher's new play, Groucho Marx Meets T.S. Eliot, for the Illusion Theater, where he also played Bill W. in Bill W. and Dr. Bob, and also Joseph Gables in Dancing with Giants. He has played James J. Hill at the Hill House for 2 seasons in a one-man show entitled Man Who Bought Minneapolis. He appears every Christmas at the St. Paul Hotel in Joe Landry's It's a Wonderful Life, a live radio play, now in its 19th season this December. And you can also see him in the Hallmark movie Rescuing Christmas. For more than 20 years, Jim was the Minister of Fun and Game host for both the Minnesota Twins and the Minnesota Wild. Ladies and gentlemen, John Gaspard and Jim Cunningham.
Thank you.
You do it.
Can I start with a question to you? Are you doing like a cool thing with the, or does your coat need to come down?
It's just up.
Because it's driving me crazy.
Thank you. Yeah, no, I appreciate that.
You should understand.
That's
we've
why
worked
we're
together
friends.
For over 40 years. I worked in meetings and events. He was often our MC. I was the last person he would see before he went on stage and the first person he'd see when he came off stage. And so we have a relationship that is called show day. On show day.
Of which this is one.
This is a show day. Everything's great. Jim, that was great. That was great. So today is show day and we're going to be very nice to each other.
That's exactly right. Meeting John 40 years ago, I auditioned for him and he hired me. And we have been friends ever since. It's been one of the greatest relationships, both personally and professionally.
Can I tell your audition story? He came in and auditioned for something. I don't remember what it was. And someone turned to me, one of the producers turned to me after that, as he was still there, and said, "What do you think?" And I said, "I think we should hire him, and I think we should keep hiring him until we can't afford to hire him anymore." And we ended up working together for 40 years.
Yeah. I never became unavailable, which was the plan, but it never happened.
Except for the last two audiobooks.
Yes. They're coming. Okay. It's going to happen. I'm getting a new computer this week, and everything will be fine again.
All right. Because Steve Hendrickson is right there.
I saw him. I saw him when he came in. I thought, there's my replacement. He's at the show. I've had just a blast being your partner and friend, recording the books. I'm looking forward to recording the next two, as you well know. But talk, first of all, you've had such a diverse career. We met, as you said, doing corporate events together. But before that, you were writing the Lucky Luke television show. You had written screenplays. Just talk a little bit about your background for everybody.
Well, I made my living in corporate America. And in my spare time, I made low-budget movies that cost between... I think one of them was the cost of lunch. It was a lunch for everybody for 8 weekends. And then there was one that we did that cost about $30,000, which is a lot of money to not get back. Did that for quite a while. And one thing you learn about doing low-budget movies when you don't have any money is that you end up carrying a lot of gear. And as I got older, that got harder and harder to do because now it's lighter, but at the time, stuff was heavy. I always had thought, well, I eventually will stop doing that and I'll do novels. When I was 16 years old, I was in a film class and director came in. We just made a movie and he held up a book by a writer, a filmmaker named William Bayer. And the book was called Breaking Through, Selling Out, Dropping Dead, and Other Notes on Filmmaking. And he said, read this book. And I did. And it's a great book. And then William Bayer, about 5 years later, put out a second edition. And the second edition was basically the same as the first, except he had little asterisks throughout saying, I was wrong. And at the very end, he said, this is an insane business. I'm going to go off and write novels. And that's what he did for the rest of his life. And so in the back of my mind at 16, I went, okay, well, that's something to, you know, put on the back burner for when I don't want to lug gear anymore.
All these years, I never knew that story. The books you wrote originally were nonfiction, and they had to do with making low-budget movies.
Yes. The first couple books were all about the movies I'd made and how you as a filmmaker could follow that same path and make your own movies. From that, I went into interviewing other filmmakers about how did they make their low-budget movies. So I talked to people like Roger Corman and Steven Soderbergh and Jon Favreau and a lot of cool people about how they made their movies and put those out. So yeah, their first stuff was all nonfiction.
And when we would travel together corporately, we would often go to a bookstore and John would immediately go to where his books were and he would take them out and reface them so that they were...
All writers do it, don't you? Reface your books, yep.
Let's talk then about making the transition from writing about low-budget movies to fiction. And that first book was called The Ripperologist,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
Talk about that book. Give us a little thumbnail of what the book is about.
Sure. Like many things in my life, it's your fault. Because I was in London with you for some reason, from show or something, and we went to what's called a Ripper Walk in London. And we happened to go on the night that a guy named Don Rumbelow was doing it. And Don Rumbelow was a former policeman in London, and he wrote what at the time was the definitive book about Jack the Ripper and the victims and the suspects and all of that. And then I got home, and I read a couple more books on it because you got me interested in the Ripper. And then I read the book by, I'm blanking on her name. She's a...
Yeah, Patricia...
Patricia Cornwell.
Yeah.
Yes, where she solved the Ripper case. And she solved it only if you're willing to ignore a lot of stuff. She would say things like, well, I can't prove that Walter Sickert was in London at the time, but I can't prove he was anywhere else. So he was probably in London. It's like, well, no. And I got really upset at it. And I thought, what if you took Patricia Cornwell, big deal writer, very successful writer,
yeah,
and Don Rumbelow, expert on Jack the Ripper, and someone was recreating all the murders exactly the way they were done, and they had to come together and solve it. So you have an expert who's British and very polite, and someone who has no idea what she's talking about, really, and knows that, and she knows to herself, yeah, I don't really have it, but I'm an expert now, and now I'm being called on this thing. And so they came together to solve the problem of who was this copycat Ripper. It was going to be a screenplay, and there was just too much going on, and I thought, I'll do it as a novel.
Yeah. I think the fellow who recorded that is in the room, isn't he?
I think he is. He's right there. Steve Hendrickson was kind enough to record that.
It's a charming book. I enjoyed reading it. I enjoyed listening to it, and you will too.
Yeah.
The Ripperologist, available where all good books are available. So now let's jump to Eli Marks and this series.
What? Again, your fault.
What? I'm taking a lot of blame, man. I'm happy to take it. But
for years, we'd be doing a corporate event, and there's a lot of standing around backstage waiting a corporate event. And for years, he had this little, like a little tiny basketball, no, soccer ball. It was just a little, you still carry?
I changed pants, otherwise it would be here.
A little ball, and he would take it, and what's called a French drop. He would look like he's putting one hand, and he'd hold it, and it's gone. And he would do it constantly for hours because as a magician, I found out you have to do it. You have to do that constantly. And then he said, you know, there's a magic convention in town. Why don't you come see it? And it was over a weekend at a hotel here in town. So I went and saw it. You know, like the first guy we saw was a guy named John Carney, who's like one of the top five magicians in the world. So I saw great people, and I thought, oh, that's fascinating. And Jim knows about magic, and as it turns out, his brother also knows about magic. So I got immersed in it, and I thought, if I'm going to do a series, that's a really good character, a magician, because he's a performer, so he's neurotic. And he...
I resemble that remark.
And he has a reason to be in a lot of different environments. I mean, if you look at Jessica Fletcher as Murder, She Wrote, why is she there? Well, it's her nephew's wedding, or there's some lame reason why she's there. But a magician is at a corporate event. He's at a birthday party. He's at a trade show. He's on a cruise ship. Tons of reasons for him to be somewhere. And he has a particular set of skills that allow him to look at something and go, oh, I know where the deception is happening there. So it seemed like a very good idea. I had no idea there would be 10 of them at the time. I would have done things differently had I known that. But it seemed like a really good starting point, and I had great resources.
Each of the books, if you don't know, is named after a particular magic trick. The latest is Twisting the Aces. The first one, The Ambitious Card, The Zombie Ball. These are all famous magic tricks. When you start to write the book, or do you pick the trick first, and then sort of backfill? Or do you start writing the novel and go, oh, it's going to be this, I'm going to name it after this trick?
In 9 out of 10 cases, it was I came up with the trick first. The first 4 books in the series, I had an actual real live publisher. And they were very nice people. Not very great publishers, but very nice people. And the third book was going to be called The Trick That Cannot Be Explained.
Which is a famous trick.
Very famous. Any magician would go, oh, wow, that's cool. And this is many, many years ago. And she sent me an email saying, you can't call it that. It's too long to tweet. So I sort of backpedaled on that one because I was kind of into it a ways and changed that to the Miser's Dream, which is another great trick. But everything else is, I've always known what the trick is because generally the trick ties in somehow either to what he's doing or why he's doing it, or like this famous trick called The Professor's Nightmare. And in that particular book, Eli's uncle is thinking of moving into a rest home. And the guy next door to him is a former university professor and keeps waking up screaming, and they don't know why. So Professor's Nightmare kind of tied into that. So generally, yeah, I'm going to know the trick.
Describe the process for me. So do you just look at a blank page and start writing? Or is there, knowing you a little bit like I do, is there a lot of note-taking and you know, diagramming, so you know, okay, in this chapter this, in this chapter this, in this chapter this, and here's how it ends?
I almost always know how it ends because I have to know where I'm headed. And I generally have a pretty good idea. I mean, I'll spend months just taking notes and coming with a thought. Who's the killer? Why are they the killer? What's the clever way they're doing it? How is Eli figuring it out? Does Eli get it right? Because a lot of times Eli gets it wrong and puts himself in a worse situation because he got it wrong. And then I have it pretty well detailed out for the first three quarters. And then I let the last quarter be sort of fuzzy because things change.
Right. And then you just ride it out until you get it. I will say one of the things that I like a lot about the Eli Mark series, obviously, but one of the things I like is they're very fair in the mystery genre. When you figure it out at the end, you can go back and it's all there and you go, oh yeah, it was, and I just didn't see it until this moment in time.
We'll be back for more Masters of Mystery after a word from our sponsors.
It's no mystery where you find the best munchies. It's under the Old Dutch windmill at your favorite snack store. For over 90 years, Old Dutch Foods has proudly delivered taste sensations to families throughout the Midwest. Old Dutch is a Minnesota-made, family-owned company committed to quality and flavor that brings everyone together. Whether you're enjoying a gathering with loved ones or reading your favorite mystery, Old Dutch snacks make every moment special. Join us in celebrating the flavors that have delighted loyal fans for generations. Old Dutch. Quality lives here.
Welcome back, sleuths and savants. It's time to rejoin Masters of Mystery.
Is there anything from your sort of filmmaking background and all the work that you did making low-budget films, writing screenplays, writing books about making low-budget films that is applicable to mystery novels?
The editing process is very similar. The difference is when you're making a low-budget movie and you find a scene that you don't need while you're in editing and you throw it away, you look at it and go, oh, that was the whole weekend and we got up early and all those people came and feel terrible about it. Whereas when you're writing a book, you go, oh, all right, that's gone, and you cut it out. And you learn in that editing process to just cut out all the boring stuff. So if I'm rereading it and I start to skim, I go, okay, we got to trim there. You got to trim. You and I talk about Columbo a lot. We love Columbo. But one of the things that Columbo does that a lot of series of that time did is they have what's called shoe leather. There's a lot of Columbo walking from a thing to a thing and a thing to a thing and a thing. And if you find you're adding shoe leather to the book, you've got to cut it out. You've got to go from that moment to this moment and get everything out in between. But sometimes you have to write that in between before you can throw it away.
That sounds like a lot of work. That's much easier to just read the books than it is to write them. You mentioned that the first four novels were, you used a publisher.
Yep.
And you mentioned that they were very nice people, not particularly good for your purposes. And then you...
I bought back the rights and hired a new designer and did all new covers for, there were five books at that point, and just relaunched it as my company, Albert's Bridge Books.
Would you recommend that? That seems like a tricky thing to me. You're a one-man band. You're doing everything. You're writing the novels. You're editing the novels. You're publishing the novels, that seems like a lot.
It is. There's never a point during the day where there isn't something I could be doing or should be doing. As my fellow sisters in crime know, some of us are that kind of writer and some of us are working with a publisher, and there's pluses and minuses to both of them. I prefer the control, and I also prefer, when I had a publisher, when they bought the ambitious card, they said, we have a contract here, we want to do 3 books, and here's the schedule. And I said, I already have a job. I don't need another schedule. I'll write it when I write it. And they said, well, then you can't be contracted. We'll just take them as they come. But I understand that when you finish the book and hand it to us, it'll be out in a year. Mm. Well, that's a long time to wait.
Yeah.
Now, when I finish a book, it's out right now. I mean, I hit a button on, boom, it's on Amazon and it's done. So I prefer that rather than waiting a year. And if you want to have a publisher, you generally have to get an agent, and that's another year and a half finding an agent. You know, I'm on the back nine here. I don't have time for all of that.
I understand. You and I are both a big fan of Penn and Teller's Fool Us. We watch that show. We enjoy that show. One of the things that I enjoy about that show is the more you know about magic, the more, I don't know if you folks watch the show or not, but Penn and Teller have a show where they have magicians come on and do a trick for them. And if they can fool Penn and Teller, if Penn and Teller can't tell them how they did it, which happens once every 10 times probably, they win a trophy. Nothing else, just the trophy. No prize money, nothing, just the trophy for fooling Penn and Teller. But in describing how the trick is done, Penn is able to tell the magician that he understands what they did and how they did it, but he doesn't tell the general audience is unaware of what Penn is saying. And oftentimes in your books, you have to do that same song and dance. When we interviewed Teller from Penn and Teller, one of the things that Teller said that I really enjoyed was that you get that part of it, you get the magic part of it for magicians right. And that's no small thing.
That I got that in an email from Teller of Penn and Teller. John, I read your book. He was wrong about who the killer was, so I did fool him. But he said, you get the magic right, and that's very rare in this kind of book. And that was from the beginning. You know, when I look back on that Patricia Cornwell book and wanting to throw it across the room, I didn't want a magician to read it and go, that's just wrong. There was a TV series that was on in the 80s called The Magician with Bill Bixby, shot at the Magic Castle. And if you watch it now, you go, well, that's just ridiculous. That's not, they're just editing. He's not doing magic. That's right. So I wanted the magic to be accurate for a magician, but not give anything away to a reader who didn't want to learn anything. And that's always been the balance. And to do that, I was very, very lucky. We have a lot of fantastic magicians here in the Twin Cities, including Larry Kalo at Eagle Magic. His magic store, when it was downtown, is the model for the one in the books. The one he has now is a little slicker, but the one downtown was just a dust magnet. It was just
fabulous.
It was fabulous. It was
fabulous,
just great
place.
If you think you have allergies now,
yeah, right,
going in then,
I am for the first time in my life experiencing allergies. I've never had them, and now suddenly it's all I can think about. Another great magician in the room is my brother, who's sitting right there. And if John can blame me for a lot of things, I can blame my brother for most of those things. So my interest in magic came through my brother. He was and is a performing magician. But in my formative years as a teenager, I was his backstage help. I would put the rabbit in the box and the dove in the pan and play the music and help him load in and load out. His wife, Sue, who is here, was often the girl in the box. So it was a wonderful period in my life, and my interest in magic came from my brother. So if you can blame me, you're really blaming my brother,
Eli
just
Marks
so you know.
Comes from your brother.
That's exactly right. So
anyway, I was very lucky because there are fantastic magicians in town. I was able to take lessons on how to perform the ambitious card from a magician named Suzanne, who has performed at the Magic Castle, who fooled Penn and Teller.
She did.
Matt Dunn lives in town. He helped me with things. The magic community is so small, not just here, but everywhere, that you can send an email to somebody, to David Regal, who's a magician in California, and say, I have a question about this. Boom, you'll get an answer back.
Yeah.
So I was able to have people check throughout that I was getting the magic right, because I am not a magician. I do exactly as many tricks as Rob does. One.
It's the next evolution of all of it. So you've written these books. Your idea to host a podcast together has been so much fun and so joyful for me. I know it's a buttload of work for you. All I do is show up, much like tonight. You have done the lion's share of everything. And so in our podcast, we will interview famous magicians. Teller.
Lance Burton.
Lance Burton, who's a big fan of the
Dick
series.
Cavett.
Dick
Kreskin.
Cavett. Kreskin.
Yeah.
Some really cool people. And if you listen to the podcast, you're going to hear John and I talk a little bit. Then we will interview somebody who can talk a little bit about something that's coming up in this particular book. And then you'll hear a chapter of the book. And if you listen to the entire first season, you're going to hear the entire book, The Ambitious Card, for free. And you're going to have fun listening to these interviews of these famous magicians. Teller, for instance. As you look back on that, because there have been a lot of great people that we've talked to, is there anything that jumps out at you? You got a favorite memory? I've got one.
Well, it might be the same one, because you already mentioned him. So you've all heard of Penn and Teller, right? They were just in town. Teller does not speak during the act, but he does speak in real life. And he, like I say, loved one of the books, was very, very nice. Let me use a quote of his in one of the books, because you can get to anybody in the magic world. You know, I knew someone who knew him, so I was able to get to him. Anyway, he agreed to come on the podcast with another local magician named Michael Callahan, because Michael has been mentored by Teller. And I said, well, let's get these two guys on and we'll talk about the mentorship process. So it's Teller. And he's on the other side of the Zoom, and Jim's on a Zoom, and Michael's on a Zoom. And I begin the podcast by saying, well, we want to talk today is about the mentorship process, because Teller is the mentor and Michael's the mentee. And Teller goes, no, 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 stop, 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 stop. And I thought, oh, boy.
This is my favorite memory, too, because of all the people I know, John is one of the smartest humans in my life. And I wasn't sure where we were going, but to be 30 seconds into the podcast and have the smart one of us stop, stop, stop,
stop. There's no such word as mentee. That drives me crazy. Okay. He was a Latin teacher before he was a magician. So he went into this thing about Odysseus left, and he left his son with Telemachus. And his son was mentor, and so the actual term is Telemachus, and he's the mentor. And that's the only thing I'm really ever upset about. So I'm glad we got that out of the way. And then the rest of it was just heaven. He was just delightful.
He really was. But what a great moment for me. For me.
Well, me
because usually the shoe is on the other foot. You are telling me, no, you can't say that. That's not right. So to have that happen.
The other one I'd say was getting Dick Cavett on. And we made that a two-part episode because he loves magic, but no one ever wants to talk to him about it. They want to talk to him about what was it like with Marlon Brando on the show or
Groucho.
Or Groucho and all that. And he's been a magician since he was a teenager. I mean, he went and saw Johnny Carson perform as a magician in Nebraska. He knows and loves magic. And so when I reached out to his PR person, I thought, I bet he doesn't get asked this a lot. I'll bet he'll do it. And he was like, yeah, when? Yeah, you want to do it twice? What do you want to do? Yeah, and he was just, he had great stories.
He really did. Very fun. Check out that podcast. It's where you can find all podcasts.
It's called Behind the Page, the Eli Marks podcast. And it's free. You can hear the first five seasons, hear five of the books for free, and we're starting season six.
Yeah, and it's been really enjoyable.
Can I just say, one of the things people ask me on occasion is, Why do you give your audiobooks away for free?
That's a good question.
And given that you get half the royalties on those, it's a question you should be asking more often than you do.
This is what I mean.
Because there's two kinds of audiences in the world. There's the audience that wants things for free, and there's the audience who will sample it for free and then go buy it. And that's the audience we're looking for. So we don't do commercials. We don't have ads of any kind, except you get to hear a chapter every episode. And invariably, well, ever since we started it, which we did during COVID, the audiobook sales have gone up because people listen to the first couple and go, I'm not going to wait till the end of the year to find out how this ends. I'll just go get it on Audible. Yeah.
We'll be back after a word from your local station.
Potato chips, kettle chips, ripple chips, or maybe popcorn or puffcorn or pretzels. Old Dutch makes them and a whole lot more. Your snack cravings can be satisfied by grabbing a bag, box, or jar of your favorite at your favorite store. Just look for the Old Dutch windmill. Old Dutch is a Minnesota-made, family-owned company committed to quality and flavor that brings everyone together. Whether you're enjoying a holiday gathering or lounging at the beach, Old Dutch snacks make every moment special. Old Dutch. Quality lives here.
Welcome back. It's time to rejoin Masters of Mystery.
In addition to, you mentioned writing a book where you interviewed Roger Corman. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of people you interviewed.
Yes.
Like 60, 70 people.
Not in that book, but over the years I've interviewed over 100 filmmakers.
So in those interviews, is there anything you picked up that might have either intuitive or counterintuitive?
Yes, it's a piece of advice that was given to me by Bob Odenkirk, who you might know as Better Call Saul, among many other things.
Yeah, yeah.
And I first heard of him. He directed a movie called Melvin Goes to Dinner, which was based on a play called Fire Giants that I directed at the Fringe with my wife. Anyway, I was talking to him about Melvin Goes to Dinner and making movies, and he's a very serious guy for being as funny as he is, very thoughtful. And I said, what advice would you give me? And he said, be sure you hesitate to hesitate. And I said, okay, thank you. Thank you, Bob. He said, here's what I mean. You need to hesitate. You need to hesitate. I said, okay, how do you mean? He said, okay, in the filmmaking world, you've set up a shot. You've shot it from several different angles. You're about to tear it all down. Don't be afraid to hesitate. Take a moment. What else can I do here? It's not going to be here tomorrow. It's all going to be gone. So hesitate. Don't be afraid to hesitate and just take that moment of what else can I get here? And if you apply that to the writing process, I'm about to hit send on sending this book to Amazon. Maybe I'll give one more check. I'm going to send this out. I'm going to reread it one more time. And just be willing to stop. Take a moment, don't hesitate to hesitate, and see if you can do anything else while you're there.
That's great advice. I don't ever hesitate.
One more piece of advice I got, which I think you as an actor will enjoy.
Give it to me.
Roger Corman made the movie Little Shop of Horrors. And he...
Not the musical.
Not the musical, the original.
The original.
One, which was shot essentially in 2 days. He had a standing set. He did some exteriors later, but it was essentially 2 days. He hired and paid the actors for 5 days. And they rehearsed for 3 days and shot for two. What does that tell you about the importance of rehearsal?
Yeah. Always huge.
Yeah. He paid more for rehearsing than he did for the actual acting.
Wow.
Yeah.
Which is not always the case.
He also spoke in complete sentences and complete paragraphs. It was like, because he was half engineer, half producer. And he's like, you just type it up and you're done. It was really easy to edit.
Yeah, I like that. When you make a movie, there's a lot of moving parts. It's a long process. Mm-hmm. You've made several low-budget films on 16mm, on VHS. It's a long slog from the blank page to something that you can put into a machine and have people watch. Are there things that you learned from the process that are valuable to you as a mystery writer?
As any kind of writer, particularly if you're going to do something long form, be aware it's going to take a while and don't let that stop you from doing it. You know, if I start a book, I know it's not going to be done for a year. And if that intimidates you, you're going to have a lot of trouble doing that. And also, when you're done writing for the day, don't actually finish. Leave it kind of hanging. So when you come back the next day, you can reread it and then continue right away. So you're not really ever facing a blank page after that first page.
Is there, you know, you hear a lot of writers talk about that, looking at the blank page is so intimidating. And do you face any of that? Is there any sort of like just white hot fear when you look at a blank computer screen and think, I got to fill like 200 of these?
Oh, no, it's terrifying. Why would you put it that way? No, it's a process, you know. I don't face a screen that often. Normally, I'm just taking notes on my phone or something. So it's by the time I get to the screen, I have a bunch of notes. And then I'm just adding notes. Once you reconcile yourself to the fact that it's going to take a year, then it's not so bad.
Okay. The next Eli Marks book, the one that we are about to record, Twisting the Aces.
Oh, that's book number 10. You still need to record book number 9.
That's all the time we have. But, okay. And we'll get to that, I promise. But Twisting the Aces.
Yes.
You're writing with someone for the very first time. You've got a co-writer.
Yes.
Which is interesting to me. And I'm interested in your take on working with someone else after you have done so much for so long all by yourself.
Right.
Tell us a little bit about
why. I did not see it coming. But I got an email from a guy in California who'd read all the books. And he said, I wrote a book about 10, 15 years ago about a murder at the Magic Castle. And I'm a Magic Castle member. And I think it could be the basis for an Eli Marks book. Do you want to read it? And one of the most frequent things I'm asked by magicians is, why have you never done a book where Eli's at the Magic Castle? It kind of makes sense that he'd be out there. And I've never been there, so I've never written one because I have no idea. I couldn't write it properly. I don't know the rooms. I don't know any of it. So this fellow, Michael Varma, sent me his book, and it wasn't an Eli Marks book, but the core thing, the person who was murdered and some of the steps and why and who, would work. So I said, we can do this, but I'm going to throw all your characters away, and I'm going to bring in the cast from Eli Marks.
That's right.
They're going to pull up in a trailer and come in, and they're going to take over the story, and I'm going to rewrite the outline so that it works for that. So I rewrote the outline, and he agreed to all the changes. And I said, the next mean thing I'm going to do is you're going to write each chapter first, and then I'm going to rewrite it because I want all the Magic Castle stuff to be baked in. I don't want to be adding it afterwards. And he was fine doing that. And by about halfway through the book, and he'd be the first to agree with this, I still rewriting stuff, but he definitely got the voice and figured out Eli's sense of humor and how that all worked. And all the Magic Castle stuff is stuff I could never have come up with because I just don't know the building, and he knows the building. So the book, which takes place over the course of one night, is part mystery, but also kind of a tour of the Magic Castle, because they end up in every room at one point or another, and Eli has to learn how to get from room to room. And so if you never get to the Magic Castle, which I've never done still, I at least know what it's like inside there.
That should be on our list. I've been once, but yeah. It would be so much fun to go with you and my brother. It'd be very fun. Very, very enjoyable. So let's put that on the list. I'm going to jump now because I know I'm watching the clock just like you are. I want to talk about the new book that's coming out. Some people will call it a coffee table book. But you are, if you want to talk to somebody about film, John would be at the top of my list to recommend. His knowledge of film and films is encyclopedic. And one of your favorite films is Harold and Maude.
Yes.
I know, Rick, you like that movie. You and Sue like that movie. I saw it with you when I was a kid. I did not like that movie. I was a kid, and it just didn't resonate with me, and I've never gone back to it. I probably should, because things change. But it's one of your favorite movies. Is it your favorite?
That changes, but it's, you know, if I'm doing Desert Island Discs and I can only have one movie, it would probably be Harold and Maude or okay. Murder in the Orient Express.
All right. So tell us about this book and what
was... Okay, it's not a mystery, so I'm allowed to talk about things that aren't mysteries here? It's a mystery why I did it. Some of you may remember, if you've lived here, that the movie Harold and Maude ran for 2 years, over 2 years, at the Westgate Theater in Edina, Minnesota, in the neighborhood of Morningside. And because of that two-year run, the movie, which had bombed when it opened and had disappeared and had not resurfaced, became a cult film and went on to run for months in Detroit and in Boston and in Paris and in Toronto. It became a cult movie, and that happened because of those 2 years at the Westgate Theater. And I was there because I was in junior high and in senior high during that time, and I was an usher after the fact. And I thought, I think there might be a book in how did the theater get to the point where they were showing this movie. And that's pretty interesting because the guy who built it was a violinist for the Minneapolis Orchestra and decided he wanted to build a movie theater with no background in movies at all. And then he died right after it opened. And so they had to sell it to a competitor. And the poor theater for 40 years was just barely getting by. It was a second-run theater in a corner of Edina. And then a little movie called The 12 Chairs went into the theater, Mel Brooks' second movie,
yeah,
and played for 12 weeks. And then Where's Papa came in and played for 36 weeks. And the owners of the theater at that time said, oh, this is where you put quirky movies. We'll put this Harold and Maude in and see if that runs. So they were going to put it in on Wednesday, March 22nd, 1972. On Monday, March 20th, this is just for the older folks in the building, the columnist Will Jones wrote in his column, I'm connecting with you, we both know this, he wrote in his column, there's a short called De Duva that I saw a year ago, and I've been begging them to bring it back, and they're bringing it back on Wednesday with a movie called Harold and Maude. You've got to see this short. Go see it. And Wednesday night, sold out house to see De Duva, and they stuck around for Harold and Maude, and they kept coming back. Because of the Westgate, it became a cult film. The history of the theater is fascinating. The history of the movie and how it got made is fascinating. And the history of what happened to both of them after the fact. Where did Harold and Maude go, and where did the theater go? And it's, like you said, it's a coffee table book. It's got 160 pictures in it. I tracked down the original designs for the theater. Just packed with Harold and Maude stuff and movie stuff. It's a beautiful book.
Where do you get it?
We can't get it right this minute. It's in England right now. It's being printed over there and will be available through all booksellers, I'm guessing, by Labor Day, maybe?
That's good. Christmas is coming, everybody.
Yeah.
Christmas is coming. I'm going to just leave one question here, and then if there are questions from you folks, I'll be happy to help facilitate that. What is next, do you think? Because the Harold and Maude book was a complete surprise, at least for me.
It was. I can't say a lot about this except that a local theater likes my Como Lake Players mysteries and have asked if one of them could become a play.
Interesting.
And the Como Lake Players mysteries take place at a community theater in St. Paul where murders keep happening. And so it kind of makes sense that a community theater might want to do a play about a community theater.
We'll
see what happens with that.
Yeah. So stay tuned, and as soon as that becomes clearer, we'll get you that information.
We'll be back for more Masters of Mystery after a word from our sponsors.
I'm the threat that's already inside the house. In the closet, under the bed, in the car. But I don't want your money. Or your TV. I can't be scared away or negotiated with. I'm patient and quiet. I don't sleep. You can't call the cops on me. You can't even see me. I'm the threat of family fire. And as long as your guns aren't stored securely, I'll be there. Protect your family. Secure all your guns. Learn how to make your home safer at endfamilyfire.org. That's endfamilyfire.org. A public service announcement brought to you by Brady and the Ad Council.
Ladies and gentlemen, pets, imaginary friends, take a listen down memory lane and spread the 411 with 97.5 FM WFHR's Unlabeled, your 90s mixtape. If it was released from 1990 to 1999, we will play it Sunday nights 8 to 9. Send me your requests with your beeper, or maybe DM me on the socials, or email me james.maloff@civicmedia.us. Sunday nights 8 to 9 on WFHR's Unlabeled, your 90s mixtape. Booyah!
Are unauthorized immigrants eligible for federal Medicaid coverage? No. Unauthorized immigrants are not eligible for traditional federally funded Medicaid health insurance and never have been. A 1996 law also requires most authorized immigrants to wait 5 years for eligibility. 14 states, not including Wisconsin, use state funds to cover unauthorized immigrants. President Trump has proposed cutting federal Medicaid funds to those states, which could drop 1.4 million people from health care coverage. In Wisconsin, Medicaid covers 1.28 million people at a cost of $12.1 billion. I'm Trisha Young for Wisconsin Watch. Fact briefs are bite-sized fact checks of trending claims produced by Wisconsin Watch and GigaFact. Learn more at wisconsinwatch.org.
This is Beth, host of The Kitchen's Open. Have you ever found yourself asking,
what's a recipe for cookies my kids will love?
How do I avoid giving my guests food poisoning?
How would a restaurant chef prepare this meal?
If so, then tune into The Kitchen's Open, the show within the morning show each Monday morning at the start of the 10 o'clock hour. I'll tackle topics, teach techniques, or tell you what to do or not to do when it comes to cooking or the kitchen. I'll also bring you interviews with local chefs and restaurant owners. The Kitchen's Open, brought to you by the Hotel Mead. We'll tell you something good.
As seasons change and years fly by, one thing remains consistent: Old Dutch. For over 90 years, Old Dutch Foods has proudly delivered taste sensations to families throughout the Upper Midwest. Old Dutch is a Minnesota-made, family-owned company committed to quality and flavor that brings everyone together. Whether you're enjoying a gathering with loved ones or simply treating yourself, Old Dutch snacks make every moment special. Join us in celebrating the flavors that have delighted loyal fans for generations. Old Dutch. Quality lives here.
Welcome back. It's time to rejoin Masters of Mystery.
Just raise your hand. Yes, Lorna.
You're not a magician, and yet the magicians who read your book say, oh, you got the magic right. So you really could be a magician. You know the tricks, right?
There's a famous magician named Max Maven that you've never heard of, but every magician has. And he said something very interesting. He said, just because you know how doesn't mean you can. So, you know, I will watch a magic trick, and in many cases, I'll know how. Doesn't mean I have the skill to actually execute it. What you did tonight doing a card trick that you just learned normally doesn't work as well as it worked for you.
Yeah.
It takes hundreds or thousands of hours to really be great at it. You have to do that forever. So I know more about it than most people, but I can't really do it. And I don't want to either. I'm not a performer.
I have a question. You mentioned Suzanne the magician. Suzanne was actually for many years a part of our family. And we moved from where we lived before. We live in Apple Valley now, and we lost contact. So after this, I'd like to talk to you because we love Suzanne.
We all do. There's
one of a kind.
Best tabletop magician I've ever seen.
Yeah, she's very good.
Fooled Penn and Teller.
Suzanne Sinclair is her name. Magic by Suzanne was her show. I don't know if she's still active or not.
She does restaurant work.
Does she?
Oh, yeah. She keeps busy.
She's about 4 foot nothing. Yeah. Other questions? Questions?
What's the name of the movie book you were just discussing?
Well, the Harold and Maude book?
Yeah.
It's called Heldover, Harold and Maude at the Westgate Theater.
Oh, great. Thank you.
Other questions?
You know, it also played at the Highland Theater at the same time. And the park, yeah, Parkway's doing it again this February, too. Always comes back, yes.
Tell me about where is the Magic Castle. I want to go.
What is it? Okay, Magic Castle is, it's a castle. It's a big old Victorian house, kind of in the middle of Hollywood. And in the 1960s, a couple brothers bought it. They were both interested in magic, and they turned it into what was supposed to be a clubhouse for magicians, a place for magicians to go to just kind of hang out. And they would do shows for each other, and then it started to grow. You can bring friends to see the shows, and we'll put in a restaurant. And now it's a huge, thriving thing where you need to know someone who belongs to get a ticket to get in. And then when you're in, you can have a lovely, very high-end dinner, and then go from room to room. You can see a bunch of shows in one night. They have a close-up theater that holds about, a dozen people? And then the Peller or the Palace of Mystery. See, I've never been, so I don't know. I only read the book. Yeah, so they have a bigger theater, and then they have places all over the castle for you to see magic close up. And you're going to see the best magicians in the world.
You also should know that in the book, Twisting the Aces, there is, at the very beginning, an architectural depiction of all the floors of the Magic Castle and all the rooms. So it will help you if you're a visual person. Any other questions?
So you mentioned that you know how the book is going to end as you're writing it. What about the steps in between? Do you ever get surprised as to how you get that ending out? Or do you have it, plotted, A, B, C, D, E, F, G, right to the end?
I leave a lot of wiggle room. And I did have a friend point out to me after several books something I hadn't noticed, which was almost all the time Eli gets it wrong. And because he gets it wrong, he gets in face-to-face with the killer and has to. And I hadn't realized how often he got it wrong. So that was subconscious, I guess. But I don't do a lot of... Once you get the spine, it's hard to jump off the spine, because you need to keep the story going. I did find in the first book, The Ambitious Card, that at one point I ran out of suspects because they're either dead in jail or in the hospital. I went, I don't have any more suspects. That's a mistake. And Eli is at the point walking out of the hospital in a revolving door, and a character comes in the revolving door that I added at that moment. And then went back and put him in the rest of the book. But since then, I've planned a little better than that. But the hard part is, every book occasionally adds another character. So there's Eli and his wife and his uncle and his uncle's new wife and his friend and his ex-wife. And you have to put him in a new environment where there's a lot of new people. Otherwise, it's the same old people over and over. And none of them did it because they're regulars in the series. So it's always a question of finding a place to put them, which is why the Magic Castle is great, because it's just full of people.
Other questions?
Okay, I may have missed the timeline here on the book about the murder at the Magic Castle.
Yeah.
Is that not released yet? Or
Twisting the Aces is out. You can buy it anywhere you buy books. In fact, you can probably even buy it tonight.
Okay, that's the one you're talking about, it took case in all the rooms.
Twisting the Aces, yes, that's in all the rooms. Yes.
Okay, good.
The only thing you can't get for that is the audiobook.
Okay. I want to be clear. I am not a blamer or a shamer.
Anyone else?
Does your series build chronologically? So you would want to maybe start with the first one if you were going to read them? Or
you can read them in any order, but Eli's life evolves during the course of the books, from meeting someone to breaking up with someone to becoming engaged, becoming married, to Harry backing, because his uncle Harry runs the magic shop, and that's where Eli grew up, to Eli taking over the magic shop. So there is an evolution, but you can jump in anywhere because it explains itself as it goes along.
I have a question for Jim.
Oh, okay.
What Where are you now? What are you doing? What's
Well, just started my treadmill season. I have hosted a show at the Minnesota Renaissance Festival for, this is my 34th year hosting that show. I'm not proud of that. I'm just saying it. The numbers are true. And so I do that until the end of September. And then I'll have a week off. And then I'll start a Halloween show out there called The Phantom's Feast. I did a show here in the cities called Hauntings or Do You Believe in Ghosts, which is largely magic tricks that look like a spirit phenomena. And I have twisted that show a little bit, and I do it out there at the Renaissance Festival. We have a nice dinner together. I tell you some ghost stories that I've collected about the Renaissance Festival grounds and the building that we perform in. And we have a little seance at the end of the show, try to reach the spirits, and we often do. And then when the show's over, I always invite paranormal investigators or psychic mediums to join us, and we go on a little ghost walk around the festival grounds, and we try to contact the spirits through paranormal investigation techniques and also spirit medium techniques. And that show runs until November 1st, and then I'll be at the Confluence Hotel in Hastings on Thanksgiving weekend doing a one-man version of Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol. And Charles Dickens, you might not know, was an amateur magician. So I'm going to do some magic in that show. And when that one is over, I will go to the St. Paul Hotel, where I have been for 19 years doing a show called It's a Wonderful Life, a live radio play that John originally directed. So
there's Jim Cunningham, a guy that can't hold a job for very long. But he's been doing it for 40 years. Congratulations. Ladies and gentlemen, let's give a big round of applause for these two wonderful, wonderful people. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Also, Dave Bruns is here. Dale, give Dave the mic because he has an event that I forgot to mention.
My name's David Bruns. I'm one half of a military veteran co-writer team. And in September, we are going to be celebrating our 10th co-writing anniversary and the launch of our 11th book. So a couple of months ago, we decided we were going to make a celebration out of it. So we partnered with a local brewery, the Savage Tap, down in Savage, Minnesota. So on September 25th, 7 to 9 p.m. So it's an unconventional book launch. We're going to have our own beer on tap. It's called Pilsners and Plotlines. And it's a public event. And to make it a little more special, we're partnering with Believe It Canine Services Partners in Northfield, which provides service dogs to veterans with PTSD free of charge. Mm. And the proceeds from the evening are going to go to them. So I have flyers with all the information. If you'd like to come, we'd love to have you. Readers are welcome. Authors are welcome to come meet readers. And it's just an evening of sea stories and celebration.
Thank you.
That's all for tonight, folks. Thanks for joining Masters of Mystery, and please come back next month as we once again converse with some of the world's most celebrated mystery writers in our quest to understand the minds behind the murders. In the meantime, please support your local bookstores, and in particular, buy the books of these authors who have entertained us tonight. Until next time, take the time to hug your kids and read a good book. This is Rob Young signing off.
It's no mystery where you find the best munchies. It's under the Old Dutch windmill at your favorite snack store. For over 90 years, Old Dutch Foods has proudly delivered taste sensations to families throughout the Midwest. Old Dutch is a Minnesota-made, family-owned company committed to quality and flavor that brings everyone together. Whether you're enjoying a gathering with loved ones or reading your favorite mystery, Old Dutch snacks make every moment special. Join us in celebrating the flavors that have delighted loyal fans for generations. Old Dutch. Quality lives here.
Now, as a fog drifts over the moors and cobblestones gleam under the rain-washed lamplight, our guest authors take their final bows. The cases are closed. The curtain falls. This has been Masters of Mystery, brought to you by Old Dutch Foods. Signing off until next month, when we will once again dissect the minds behind the murders. Good night and pleasant dreams.
This is locally grown radio, WFHR 1320 AM, W248DE Wisconsin Rapids, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by O'Reilly Auto Parts.
I'm Matt Piper.
You wouldn't think that that would happen here.
That's the response to yet another mass shooting, this time in Grand Blanc, Michigan, inside a Mormon church. Police say after the gunman opened fire, he lit the place on fire. Four people are dead. Terrell Bailey is with CBS News Detroit.
The violence unfolded shortly after 10 Sunday morning at the Church of Latter-day Saints in Grand Blanc, Michigan. A gunman rammed his vehicle into the building where a church service was going on and opened fire using what authorities say was an assault rifle.
Oregon is suing the Trump administration. The state's attorney general says it's over what he calls the unlawful deployment of 200 Oregon National Guard members to Portland. Mayor Keith Wilson.
We want to fight with them beside us to focus on Medicaid and Medicare and SNAP and those benefits that our community needs so much more than boots on the ground.
There's still no word on when those troops could be deployed, but it comes as immigrants.